This is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Laura Sullivan in for Guy Raz. Has financial trouble reached your doorstep, behind in your mortgage payments, or has another tragedy hit your family? Here's a new solution.
It's never been easier to get a lump sum pension buyout or cash advance for your pension payments.
That was an advertisement for selling your pension.
People are desperate for money. They don't have a lot of other avenues to go to. So they call up one of these proliferating number of websites with names like buyyourpension.com, pensionstream.com, pensionforcash.com. And for many people, it's a way to get quick cash.
That's Leslie Sism. She's a reporter at the Wall Street Journal who's looked into a growing trend: retirees selling their pensions to get through tough times. That's our cover story today, how a pension goes from golden nest egg to quick cash in hand. Pensions are supposed to be a protection for down the road, part of a safety net, just like life insurance or a house. That's how Joe Serena thought of his pension. It came from serving 22 years in the Navy. But in 2008, his wife left him, and he had to pay child support.
I didn't want to lose my house. I had already lost my daughter. I mean, I was only going to get her every other weekend, and that's all I can think of.
Poking around on the internet, he found a company that promised retirees a bunch of cash right away. But the retirees have to hand over their pension checks for years.
They wanted me to go right into my pay, and they wanted me to reroute my pension directly to their bank every month. And the more it sunk in, it really financially didn't do anything better for me.
So here's the deal he got. The company gave Joe Serena $57,000, but Serena was supposed to give the company his $1,300 pension check every month for 8 years. Did you catch that math? Joe Serena gets $57,000, but over 8 years, the company gets $125,000. That's like taking out a loan with a 23% interest rate. Dr. Louis Crute and his wife, Kathy, shared Joe Serena's regret. After 2 decades of working in the military, Dr. Crute got in trouble with the IRS.
Through either miscommunication, misunderstanding, I did not pay the full taxes on withdrawing my retirement fund, and I ended up with a big tax bill.
Really big. The Crutes needed about 70 grand.
I panicked. I saw what I had to pay the IRS and got desperate, and I leaped before I looked.
Kathy Crute explains what happened.
In 2005, we hooked up with Structured Investments. They offered a lump sum payment for 8 years of loose retirement, and it seemed like a way that we could pay the IRS because there was no way we had that money laying around to pay them.
We tried to talk to Structured Investments, the company both the Crutes and Joe Serena used. The company didn't respond to multiple emails or phone calls. But last August, its founder, Stephen Covey, also an Army vet, told the Center for Public Integrity that the company's practices don't violate any laws. He says they aren't loaning money. They're paying for a commodity. But the Crutes sure felt like their payment came with a lot of loan-sounding terms.
The contract said that we had to pay certain bills off first before the IRS, and there wasn't enough money then to pay off the IRS.
And they also had to take out a life insurance policy made out to Structured Investments.
They're here to make money, and if for a reason I drop dead, my pension stops. I had to take out a life insurance policy.
The good news is the Crutes finally finished paying off their tax bill last month. The bad news, they have 2 more years of handing over their pension checks. Assuming they don't miss a payment, the $92,000 they got will wind up costing them about $243,000.
Using the retrospectroscope, it really was not a bright thing to do.
You could call it stupid tax.
Yeah.
In 2005, Joe Serena and several other retirees joined together in a class action lawsuit in California, arguing that the deals aren't legal. The state court ruled in their favor, but the company is expected to appeal. In the meantime, Joe Serena has stopped making his payments, but the Croots are still making theirs. Leslie Sism, the reporter from The Wall Street Journal, says investment companies so far seem to like this idea of investing in the sale of people's pensions.
There are so many financial whiz kids out there who are always willing to try to find some way to turn some consumer product into something that an investor can make money on. So there's just constant financial engineering on all kinds of income streams in particular to try to find ways to turn those into investments.
Is any pension up for sale? I mean, and are some worth more than others?
The spreadsheets we saw did include lots of pensions from state governments, New Jersey state pensions, California civil servant pensions, teacher pensions from various places, and we even saw some private sector ones, Ford Motor, Delta Airlines. We talked to financial advisors, and we were told that most of their clients, if they're willing to go for this offbeat investment, they want to do it in what they perceive as the safest possible way. So they view buying a military pension as the safest route because they feel that's from Uncle Sam. They don't have to worry about a default of that pension. The pension's going to arrive to the retiree every month.
These folks are signing over checks that come into the mail every month for them that they're supposed to live on. Is this legal?
In general, federal law does not allow the assignment of a pension. The people who put together these deals feel they're not assigning your pension to someone else. They feel that this is money that you have received from a pension. And once you receive it in your checking account, you're allowed to do what you want with that money. The courts have ruled differently. A few courts have, in fact, concluded that these successfully thread the needle. The thinking being that the money is in the retiree's hands and he can control it and he can even break that contract.
The pension checks that end up in somebody's mail every month, how do these investors ensure that these people are actually going to send that check on to the investors every single month for 7, 8, 15 years?
They have no assurance that the retiree's going to keep his end of the bargain. He may be so desperate to start with that he is, in fact, a good candidate to default or to go into bankruptcy court.
In your article, you describe pension sales as a burgeoning business. How big are pension sales right now?
I think it's safe to say it's relatively small right now. This is not something that any of the Wall Street firms are involved with, and we called around to some big firms.
Is this something that's growing?
There are definitely efforts to grow it. There are so many investors who are frustrated with the low yields on a lot of their investments. So it seems like there's a lot of demand for offbeat investments. And then the supply is generally considered big. There really are just millions of these pension holders out there.
How does this end up working out for taxpayers?
Taxpayers are likely to react unfavorably if they hear that a lot of middlemen and an investor are making money on pensions that they fund for the benefit of that particular retiree, that veteran, that police officer, that firefighter. But that's not stopping people from trying to figure out how to make a buck being a middleman here.
If something about this sounds familiar, about taking what has traditionally been a safety net for consumers and turning it into a possible investment for Wall Street, you'd be right, according to Lawrence J. White, a professor at NYU's Stern School of Business. He says there are some similarities to mortgage securities.
A pension represents a stream of payments that are going to stretch out into the future, just the way a mortgage represents a stream of payments by the borrower back to the lender. However, the one reassuring thing should be this kind of pension securitization is never going to get anywhere near as large as the trillions of dollars of mortgage securities.
Why not?
Even if Why? There just aren't that many pensions and pension streams. Maybe a couple of billion, you know, mere couple of billion dollars at most, as compared with mortgage securities that are in the $6-8 trillion range.
So do you think that the market for pensions needs to be regulated?
At a minimum, for especially a new financial instrument like this, maybe there needs to be some kind of cooling off period where you have a chance to think twice, think three times, consult friends, consult a trusted advisor. And then beyond that, if financial institutions are investing in these things, the financial regulators ought to be there making sure they have enough capital to support the potential losses that could come from investing in a risky security.
Few, if any, federal agencies seem to have pension sales on their radars. But in an email, Senator Tom Harkin, chairman of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, called them a worrisome new practice that deserves careful scrutiny.
A scientist in Boston has been driving around the city measuring leaks in gas mains, and he's found a lot. Gas leaks are not uncommon, and gas companies spend a lot of time tracking them down and repairing them. But the scientific team says they are surprised at how many they found and what those leaks are doing to the health of the city's trees. NPR's Christopher Joyce has more.
Biologist Nathan Phillips at Boston University was intrigued with what methane from underground gas mains might be doing to trees. On a stroll through Boston, he met a former gas line inspector who said Boston's gas system was, in fact, leaky. So Phillips obtained a methane detector called a cavity ring down spectrometer and put it in a car.
We just measure while we drive. It's a very fast-acting piece of equipment.
Together, the team drove 785 miles of Boston and suburban roads. They found about 4,000 significant leaks.
Like many people, I really didn't know the scope of the problem, so I was very surprised.
In some cases, the levels were high.
The record level that we found for a leak, this is in the atmosphere that we breathe on the surface in Boston, was about 30 parts per million of methane, and that's over 15 times the normal background level.
Phillips notes that he's not a health expert and says he has no reason to believe these levels pose a risk to human health, but he does believe, as a plant physiologist, that the methane is probably harming trees.
Natural gas is largely methane. That displaces the oxygen. It's also dry gas, so it desiccates the soils as well. And roots need to have oxygen for the metabolism of the roots, for the repair of the root membranes. If they're starved for oxygen, the tree will suffer.
A state advocacy group is suing utilities in the region for damages to trees and citing Phillips' research. The plaintiffs are communities that claim millions of dollars of damage has been done to trees in the Boston area. Tom Kiley, head of the Northeast Gas Association, says it's true that methane can damage vegetation, but it's not common.
There certainly are a lot of potential causes to the damage to trees and vegetation that include insect infestation, vehicular damage, disease, storm damage, drought, salt, waste oil, gasoline.
The association represents gas companies in the region. Kylie says when there's damage, gas companies remove and replace the trees. That's confirmed by a spokesman for National Grid, the major supplier of natural gas to the Boston area. As for the leaks, Kylie says gas companies do report how much they lose statewide to the State Department of Public Utilities. He doesn't know how many leaks there are in Boston, but says leaks are a problem that the companies take seriously.
It's an older system. It is being replaced. There are some cast iron facilities and some bare steel or unprotected steel that are being replaced. So there are, in fact, leaks on the joints.
For his part, Nathan Phillips says he recognizes that the gas company is working to contain leaks. His aim, he says, is to make the information about the leaks' whereabouts and frequency easily available to the public.
The buried infrastructure, when it's out of sight, it's out of mind, and it's easy for us to just forget that it even exists.
Phillips notes methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas that warms the planet. And in fact, scientists at the company that makes the methane sniffer, Picaro, in California, have begun mapping leaks in San Francisco, too. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Laura Sullivan.
New rule, if you get to send me a ticket with a photo of me running a red light, I get to pay that ticket with a photo of me writing a check.
That's comedian Bill Maher wrapping up another installment of his show, Real Time. Every show ends with a segment called New Rules, where Maher takes a moment to talk about what's bugging him, from the inane to national issues that affect all of us.
New rule, I don't need a paper wrapper on my ice cream cone. The ice cream cone isn't a cone, you see. That's the wrapper. And finally, new rule, as long as we've got three wars going, America needs to add one more, a class war.
His new book is a collection of some rules from the show and some that never made it on the air. It's called The New Rules, a funny look at how everybody but me has their head up there, you know what. And Bill Maher joins us now. And thank you so much, Bill, for naming your book something we can't even say on NPR.
I am a bad boy, aren't I?
Well, welcome to All Things Considered.
Great to be here. Listen to it all the time.
So I'm going to open the book to a random page and just read one. Bring back lamps where the switch is on the actual lamp and not 3 feet down on the cord.
You picked the one that makes me sound like Andy Rooney.
I think I did, didn't I?
I don't know how you did that. That's a big, thick joke book. You know, I would say for people who have been following what I do for a long time, this is one of the more silly things. I don't think I'm probably known as Mr. Silly like some comedians are. But there's some really silly stuff in this book.
Some of these titles that of the rules you have, most of them are puns, and some of them are pretty complex puns. Like there's a rule about topography titled, I shot the serif. I mean, do you come up with these yourself or
you know,
does someone else do it?
It's funny you ask about that because that is the one thing. I'm kind of a micromanager, you know. I'm kind of a perfectionist, so I tend to like stick my hand in every single aspect of Real Time. But not that. That is the one thing I let my writers do. I hate puns. I don't like them. I never read them. The first time I ever saw any of these puns was when I was editing this book.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah. I mean, this book, I mean, besides the new rules, it has a lot of our longer essays, which were done on the show.
Yeah, let's talk about the longer essays.
Okay.
In the intro of the book, you write about these long editorial pieces. Please don't read this part of the book on the toilet or you'll break my heart.
See?
I mean, so much of this book is funny. Is this the part that you want people to take seriously?
Well, I hope they find this funny, too. I mean, we always try to make those funny. But yes, the last new rule we do on the show is always what we call the editorial. And it's something that is trying to make a deeper, more salient point, whereas the rules can be about anything. They can be about Kim Kardashian or Lindsay Lohan or the latest, you know, Axe body spray ad or something. We try to, you know, make a lot of them about politics and what's going on. But the editorial is something I hope people take away with and go, oh, you know what? That's something that I was kind of thinking, and he really crystallized it and said it the way I would like to say it, and I agree with that, and thank God somebody's saying that. So that's what I try to do in those.
How much emotion is going into some of these essays? Because some of these, just from reading them and from seeing them on your show, you seem very passionate about.
I am. I'm Irish, you know. Irish people get mad at anything. And the country is real screwed up, and it's a shame, especially for people who are as old as I am now and remember when it was, as Burt Lancaster said in the movie Atlantic City, this used to be a pretty good country. And you know, it still, I guess, could be again, but I think many of us think things are so off track and that there are so many greedy, selfish people who have hijacked what was good about this country. And when I hear the Republicans railing on, as they do, about American exceptionalism, they, you know, they're very obsessed with the idea that Obama will not say American exceptionalism. Well, you know what's exceptional about America, unfortunately, is, you know, we're the only advanced nation that doesn't have health care. We're number one in income inequality. We are the nation that throws the highest percentage of our own people into prison. We're number one in debt. We're number one in military expenditures. We're number one in meth labs and fat toddlers. You know, the things we're number one in these days are mostly not good things.
In one of those editorials from 2005, the opening line is, not to burst your bubble, but all bubbles burst. I was stunned when I was reading it because I looked at the date and I thought, 2005. I mean, you pretty much predicted the housing bust.
But it won't be funny when the bubble bursts and people start going bankrupt, taking banks down with them, and then the markets, and then the dollar.
I mean, this was before anybody was talking about this.
I think what's surprising is that, this comes from a comedian and not an economist, because I don't think it was that hard to see that there was a bubble. You know, for the longest time, people just bought houses for, $250,000 or something, and then they put in recessed lighting and said, it is now worth $1 million. And the banks went right along with that and co-signed it. And, people used their houses basically as ATMs.
Is there a theme in general for all of your rules? I mean, is there a basic trigger that makes
I think that's what's fun. You know, we had a new rules book out in 2005, and we did this one the same, but we considered for this book organizing it more, like gathering all the ones on gun control and putting those together, and all the ones on taxes and all the ones on war. And then we thought, no, you know what's great about this? It's the randomness of it. It's just done by alphabetical order with those silly puns as the title. And, you know, you'll have one that's sort of about a serious topic, and then you'll follow that up with one about how, you know, stop calling bagpipes a musical instrument.
Why
do you want
not?
To know why? Do
yes,
you want to know
I
why?
I want to know why now. Why?
Because bagpipes are not a musical instrument. They're a Scottish breathalyzer test. You blow in one end, and if the sound that comes out the other end doesn't make you want to kill yourself, you're not drunk enough. It's a very silly book.
Where are these ideas coming from?
I've been doing stand-up comedy for almost 30 years, and you get in the habit of remembering stuff. There are some comics who are good at deliberately writing. I've never been one of those, but I am pretty good at when something does strike me, I do write it down. And of course it happens all day long. I mean, we're bombarded, you know, with facts and trivia and TV, billboards, stores. And we live in that kind of a society where we're just constantly being, you know, reminded of stuff that's fodder for comedy. It's a like I say, a country that's going off the rails, but it's good for comics.
That's comedian Bill Maher, host of the show Real Time. His newest book is called The New Rules. Thanks so much for coming in and talking.
Hey, what a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
India's biggest celebrity is just a few days old, a tiny crown princess of Bollywood royalty. She has no name yet, but her dad is asking for suggestions, names beginning with the letter A preferred. Commentator Sandeep Roy explains why her birth made headlines.
Last week, India got the tweet it was holding its breath for. It's a girl, Aishwarya Rai Bachchan. The Bollywood actress, often called the most beautiful woman in the world, gave birth to a daughter. The proud dad, Abhishek Bachchan, a Bollywood hero in his own right, sent out the first tweet, followed moments later by his dad, Bollywood's biggest superstar, Amitabh Bachchan. This is no ordinary family. Amitabh Bachchan has been a huge star since the 70s, first as an angry young man, then a politician, then the host of India's version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. His baritone sells everything, from hair oil to Pepsi. His wife is a star, his son is a star, and daughter-in-law Aishwarya is a Miss World who became Bollywood's dream girl. Translation, this is a baby with some serious pedigree. She's not India's first celebrity baby, but she's India's first bona fide child of the unholy union between social media and celebrity media. Amitabh Bachchan first tweeted the news of his daughter-in-law's pregnancy in June. Since then, each tweet has been obsessively followed and analyzed with more zeal than an Osama bin Laden tape. But given the media circus throughout the pregnancy, I was surprised that when baby B landed, there was little paparazzi feeding frenzy. So powerful is Bollywood's first family, Indian broadcasters issued their own version of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not run any story over 90 seconds. Thou shalt not carry any photo of the child, not even cell phone snaps. Thou shalt not do an astrology show about her horoscope. It was big news earlier this month when a friend spilled the beans that Abhishek wanted a daughter. In India, there's still a huge preference for sons. That's why sex determination is banned. Despite the ban, there are fewer little girls here than little boys, and the numbers keep getting bleaker. It's tempting to think the buzz around one little girl will change this. In a Bollywood film, it might have. But the real world has its own script. 2 days before Baby B landed, I was in Mumbai visiting a friend who lived across the street from the Bachchans. "Just tell any taxi driver that and he'll be able to find my place," he told me. Somehow I managed to hail the only taxi driver in Mumbai who didn't know where the Bachchans lived. "Saab," he said, "what does it matter where these stars live? What will they do for me? Now that the newest Bachchan has arrived, I still don't have an answer for him."
Mere ghar aaye. Mere ghar aaye.
Commentator Sandeep Roy is culture editor of firstpost.com. He's based in Kolkata. You can comment on his essay on the opinion page at npr.org.
Mere ghar aaye.
Another dilemma facing parents is whether to allow their kids to drink chocolate milk. Many school districts are eliminating chocolate milk from cafeterias on the grounds that it has too much sugar and calories. But another segment of the population, runners and endurance athletes, can't seem to get enough. NPR's Allison Aubrey checks in with both camps.
When Dan DeFonso ran past the 26-mile mark at the Wine Glass Marathon in Corning, New York earlier this month, and he caught a glimpse of the finish line, he expected the tables of water and Gatorade. But what was handed to him?
As soon as I crossed the finish line, I received my finisher's medal, which I was happy to see. But the very next person handed me a plastic jug of chocolate milk. It was delicious.
DeFonso says he's always been a fan. As a kid, he loved chocolate milk. But he says only recently have runners turned to chocolate milk as a recovery drink.
I just think in years past, you would have been a little bit strange if you were to drink chocolate milk immediately after a run. But nowadays, it's absolutely mainstream, and I think everybody's just looking to find out, you know, what's that one beverage I can take that makes me feel better the next day so I can run again, and chocolate milk's been doing that for me, so I stick with it.
A spate of new research studies seems to be fueling the trend. One study found that the protein in milk speeds up the time it takes muscles to recover from intense exercise. And another study, perhaps of interest to lots of us who aren't in the habit of running 26 miles, finds that chocolate may play a role in helping people manage their weight. Researcher Josh Lambert of Penn State says it's complicated, but he's studying the unusual way that chocolate interacts with a specific digestive enzyme to block the absorption of fat.
These compounds in cocoa, these polyphenolic compounds in cocoa, inhibit the activity of that enzyme, so they block it from breaking down fat.
Basically helping the body fend off fat. But don't get too excited. It'll take more research to see how big this effect is. So here's the rub. Whatever boost the good compounds in chocolate may give us, the bum rap that chocolate milk is getting in schools is due to all the extra sugar and added calories.
In my world, chocolate milk is soda and drag. Most of it has as much sugar as actually Pepsi or Coke, and it doesn't belong in schools.
That's Ann Cooper, who directs food services at the Boulder Valley School District in Colorado. She's made a national reputation for herself as the renegade lunch lady, tapping into the national angst over how kids eat. And in her mind, tossing out chocolate milk is one easy step to address the very complicated obesity problem. Other schools are taking action, too, from L.A. to Minneapolis and D.C. There's a national rethink over chocolate milk, and even famous TV foodies are taking up the cause.
Please welcome Chef Jamie Oliver.
Chocolate milk was the focus of his appearance on the Jimmy Kimmel Show.
So what I'm saying is the parents of L.A. and America need to start giving a about what we feed kids.
That's right. And,
So it's a really good idea, right? You ban chocolate milk and schools are doing something to make kids healthier. But it's not so simple. At least that's what Penny McConnell of the Fairfax County, Virginia school says she learned.
When we eliminated it, we had as many parents who were upset with us that we did it as the ones who were pleased with it.
Some were worried that their kids weren't getting enough calcium.
I've tried regular. I don't really like it, so...
Claire Feidler says some kids won't drink milk if it's not chocolate, and her schoolmate Zachary Dondershine agrees.
I just think it tastes better. More people like chocolate more, and it has more sugar in it.
So McConnell had an idea. Why not keep the chocolate and replace the sugar? She worked with her dairy suppliers to eliminate high fructose corn syrup. Her reformulated skim chocolate milk does have sugar in it, but it only has 30 extra calories compared to a half pint of regular 1% milk. Mom Diane Dondershine says that works for her.
I'm fine with that, as long as they're getting calcium.
McConnell says what she's learned is that banning a food may not be as helpful as the much more complicated task of teaching kids to look at their whole plates and make good choices. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
For more on why the work for the supercommittee has been so difficult, let's turn to NPR's Cokie Roberts. She's with us this morning, as she is most Mondays. Good morning, Cokie.
Hi, Linda.
We just heard Senator Patty Murray talking about lawmakers being committed to a lobbyist rather than to the people. Sounds like Democratic talking points, no?
Yes, indeed. And that's what the Democrats are doing. They're going after the Republicans, saying that they're the tools of Grover Norquist, who they're characterizing as a millionaire lobbyist. And Mr. Norquist, who has exacted this tax pledge, no new tax pledge from the Republicans, is not doing anything to dispel that because, of course, it makes him seem very powerful. So he likes that. The Republicans, on the other hand, are saying that it's all the president's fault that he was AWOL throughout these super committee deliberations, and Mitt Romney particularly made that case throughout the day yesterday. But it is all political talking points as opposed to anybody really trying to get something done. There were none of those late-night huddles in the Capitol yesterday that, you know, you and I have stood outside those rooms waiting for people to come out with some announcement. None of that was going on. It was all just blame game.
So what in reality is likely to be the effect of the supercommittee's failure, if a failure is what we're looking at?
Well, on the markets, we'll see. The principals on the committees seem to think that the markets have already factored in failure of the supercommittee and that there will be no big blowback. And they keep making the point that there will be these $1.2 trillion in cuts anyway, and that that's what will have the effect on the market. So no one should panic. It's interesting to me that it's the Republicans who are the ones making this point most strongly. So clearly they are feeling some of the heat.
Now, aside from the politics, what is the likely substantive result? Will there be any real deficit reduction? Will the across-the-board reduction that's supposed to happen if the supercommittee fails, will that actually happen?
Well, first of all, the cuts are not even supposed to happen until 2013. Now, you know very well what happens when we get into the normal appropriations process. Once the supercommittee disbands, none of the special expedited procedures exist anymore. So we're back to a Senate that can filibuster, a House that can figure out ways to spend money when people aren't looking. So it is very, very hard to see, look into the future and see that those cuts will really happen. And there are all kinds of other things to factor in there, the extension of the payroll tax break, unemployment benefits, all of that will be something on the table. And, you know, so the big hope is that the economy grows and those things will be essential to that and that the country is home free. But it's hard to see our way from here to there. And, of course, there's also that big question of the Bush tax cuts expiring at the end of 2012 and what the Congress decides to do about that.
Well, let's not let a Monday go by without a small handicapping moment in the Republican presidential field. A couple of weeks ago, you said, watch Newt Gingrich, and we're watching him climb in the polls. So.
Yes, but I think we might be watching him sink in the polls after a bad week for him. And I don't know who's next, Linda, is the not Romney. Rick Santorum, perhaps. He seems to be all over Iowa. And Ron Paul, he stays sort of steady in the polls, and he's not running for Congress again. So you might watch him for a third party race, even if he doesn't win the nomination.
NPR's Cokie Roberts, thanks very much.
Thank you, Linda.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.